Thank you so much for joining Hashtag No Limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino, and Hashtag No Limits is about people whose society has placed limits upon but whom are busting through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will become. And I believe that to be 100% true. I have seen it happen thousands and thousands of times. And I believe that there is no better or more beautiful example of that change than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. Just a quick science lesson for those who may not know, the caterpillar literally dissolves back into cells and then reforms into the butterfly. Now, that's obviously a very simplified version of what's happening. However, once it's reformed into the butterfly, then it still has to struggle while it's in the cocoon in order for its wings to be strong enough to take it everywhere it's going to go. There is struggle involved in life. And while none of that the caterpillar goes through is easy, neither is busting through limits that society places upon us. And today, I'm going to bring someone on who is going to talk to us about some of the limits that have been placed on her. But before I do, I just want to remind you to make sure that you like and subscribe to this channel. If you are watching live, give us a hashtag live. If you are watching in the replay, give us a hashtag replay. You will notice that this is episode 196. And for the video version only, this will not happen for the podcast version, but for the video version only, episode 200 is going to be a huge episode. I have Merle Evans scheduled to be my guest, and we are going to have giveaways of books, St. Louis Cardinals baseball tickets, Holiday World Splash and Safari tickets, jewelry. So make sure that you have liked and subscribed so that you don't miss a single episode between now and then, but definitely not episode 200. So I believe that's all the business stuff. So I'm going to bring on Ellen and welcome Ellen so much to Hashtag No Limits. How are you doing today?
I am fantastic. And thanks so much for having me on as a guest.
Yes, absolutely. It's my pleasure. So tell me a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I'm originally from the New York City area, just outside the city. My family split our time between Westchester County and Fire Island, New York, just on the south shore of Long Island. So I grew up in two different communities simultaneously, which was an interesting experience. Yeah. If you'd like me to just go ahead and jump into my story. Okay.
Yep. Go ahead.
So at a very early age, about 6 or 7, I was diagnosed as dyslexic. But prior to that, I actually had been diagnosed as ambidextrous.
Oh,
interesting. And unfortunately, with the dyslexic diagnosis at that time, it was an academic death sentence. Mm-hmm. And my parents were told in a parent-teacher conference at that age that I would not be academically successful. I might be able to graduate from high school, but college was completely out of the question. And they should focus on finding me a husband who would take care of me, because I would not be contributing to society other than as a wife and a mother.
Wow.
Yes. So
I want to pause you there for just a second, because sadly, now you and I look to be about the same age. And so I am imagining that this was in the 1900s when this was being said. Sure. The sad thing is that as a special educator myself, even into the middle, like 2000s, early 2010s, mm-hmm. I was still hearing teachers say things like that about students with specific learning disabilities, which is the umbrella that dyslexia falls under within the special education law.
Right.
But even more so with, dyslexia, or now that we have the understanding of dysgraphia and dyscalculia, I'm still hearing that mm-hmm. that's what stemmed or grew this show, is because I want people to understand to stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Because saying that somebody at the age of 6 or 7 or 8 or even 15 or 16, well, this is all they're ever going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And putting that limit on their potential just really bugs me.
Yeah. Well, it's life destroying. You know, mm-hmm. it destroys self-esteem. It's traumatic. It sets a trajectory of a child's life. And when you do that to somebody, you also knock them down the socioeconomic ladder.
Mm.
You take mm-hmm. away opportunities and potential. And that's just unacceptable.
Yes. Yeah. And that's exactly what I mean when I say hashtag no limits. It's limiting somebody's potential. Mm-hmm. It's not that you're, you know, anybody that I've known has ever said, you know, you're literally just going to live in this box. It's right. It's that idea of that person's potential, but that has so many consequences in our mm-hmm. thinking and then into our actions and our expectations of that person, right. which I think is what we're going to get into more yes. and more today.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, I interrupted your story. So that's continue okay. on with your story.
So, fortunately, I had the parents who said no. And that parent-teacher conference ended with my mother pounding her fist on the desk, saying, I refuse to allow you to condemn my daughter. What are you going to do for her?
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting is they didn't look at what I could do or what I did really right. well.
Right.
So I was given the WIS test, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And in abstract reasoning, I scored in the 99th percentile. In logic, wow. I scored in the 98th percentile. And in the IQ, I was around, I'm pulling from memory here. These records no longer exist, unfortunately. It was at 115.
Okay. So can I pause you again? I'm sorry.
Yes,
So I just want to clarify, because when you're saying you fall in the 98th and the 99th percentile, what that means is that 97%, you're scoring better than 97% of the population for that specific test at that specific era that you were given it.
Yes.
And that IQ of 115, the WISC at one time, the average was 95 to 115. That was where like 68, I think, is the percentage of population fell within that. So you were on the very far end, on the very high end mm-hmm. of what was average at the time. So right. even, I think sometimes that's confusing to people, because when we're talking, we typically think of 100 as being the best. And right. so when we're talking about those percentiles and those IQ ranges, 50th percentile is exactly like, that's also like a 100 IQ. Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. a little confusing. So I was just trying to clarify that a little bit.
Well, thank you. I didn't know that. So
there you go. Okay.
So, yeah. So they were only looking at the dyslexic piece of it. They weren't looking at my talents and my abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And also because I was ambidextrous, the belief system at the time, and please chime in because you may know more about this than I do. The belief system at the time was that a child could not learn to read without a dominant eye. And yeah, this was a conversation.
I think that was the belief at the time, but that's been debunked now.
Right. And I'm sure you're absolutely correct. So, but the result at that time was that, they said, well, she's not ready to learn how to read because she doesn't have a dominant eye. So they actually held me back 2 years from learning to read.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So talk about being set up for failure.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and again, fortunately, my parents were, you know, involved. They were at the parent-teacher conferences. My mom became a class mom. I don't think they do that these days anymore.
Not so much.
Yeah, but she was actually in the classroom, you know, several days a week. She made good friends with my teachers and was just there all the time, making sure that I got the support that I needed. They also had tutors for me outside of the classroom, so after school. And then my father, who was a military veteran, understood that the real important learning in life happens outside the classroom. Mm-hmm. So learning to persevere, learning to overcome challenges. So he did everything he could for me, not only supporting me, you know, doing my homework and things like that, but he taught me at a very young age to pilot his boat. He taught me how to navigate. He taught me how to read the water. I remember standing on an upside down bucket so I could reach the steering wheel. So, and then, you know, at 15, he sent me on Outward Bound. I'm a big fan of Outward Bound. That adventure changed the trajectory of my life.
Would you explain what Outward Bound is? It's not something I've heard of.
Oh, okay. Outward Bound is an outdoor education school. They have programs anywhere from 1 day to 3 months. And they basically take you out into the wilderness. It can be hiking. It can be rafting. It can be sailing in Maine. They have trips all over the world. And you're in challenging situations. They send you on an 8-mile hike. They'll have you do an obstacle course. In my case, we did rock climbing and rappelling. And we had to raft. We rafted a total of 98 miles on the Green River over 2 weeks. Wow. And we had to learn to work together as a boat crew. We had to learn to work together and make sure that things got done. You know, in the wilderness and adventures, you get immediate consequences. You know, if you don't seal up your watertight bag on the raft, your clothes and your sleeping bag is going to be wet that night.
Yep. Very true. Natural consequences are amazing.
Yes. Yes. I got to experience being a leader for the first time. Learned that my skills as learning to pilot my father's boat and read the water also applied to the river. So I excelled in that environment. And also, nobody knew I was dyslexic.
Yeah.
I got to be just a regular kid, a regular 15-year-old girl for the first time in my life without judgment.
And that's awesome.
It was incredible. And again, my dad knew I would thrive in that environment, which is why he sent me. And at that time, 15 was the youngest they would take us, 14 and 15. Then at 17, he sent me off to get certified to scuba dive. So again, my mother had to sign the paperwork because I was a minor. So now at that time, again, that was the youngest they would take us. So always putting me in situations where I would learn how to persevere, how to overcome challenges, how to problem solve. And it paid off. It paid off. I love to do any kind of outdoor adventure because of that foundation. I live here in Colorado and I'm a big skier. So I'm out on the Rockies pretty much every weekend skiing with friends.
Wow, that's cool.
It's great. I also was a ski instructor for 5 years, part-time. So I taught in children's program at a mountain in New Hampshire called Attitash Bear Peak. But it was, I had just have this constant love of taking on challenges and learning and growing and learning how to persevere. Now, despite all of that, well, before I go into that, I also did go on to college, despite the expectations. In fact, when I was in high school, I was not allowed to take a foreign language, which is always a requirement for college admissions. But they had decided that I wasn't going to college. So the attitude was, why make my life more difficult if I just don't need to do that. So my parents had to step in and say, if she wants to take a foreign language, she can take a foreign language and you have no right to stop her.
Right. So
they did. I was able to do that. And I did go on to college. I have a bachelor's degree in allied health. And then many years later on a part-time basis, I went back for my MBA.
Nice. So, congratulations.
Thank you. I have a master's degree as well. But here's the thing that a lot of people don't understand unless they live through this, is that despite all those accomplishments, I still had very low self-esteem and was traumatized. I was carrying around a tremendous amount of trauma and I didn't know that. because it was so ingrained in me that I wasn't even conscious of it. I was consistently bullied. I had...
I'm sorry.
Thank you very much. I was consistently underemployed. I had, you know, abusive managers. And surprise, surprise, ended up in an abusive marriage. I was married to a narcissist. And it was mostly psychological abuse. I was married for 6 years. We did have an incident of violence. And just one, but it's always too much.
One is more than enough.
Yeah. Finally realized that I needed to get out. Spoke to an attorney who scared the bejesus out of me and said, you need to get out. You need to get out now. You are in danger. And this is something that I think a lot of people don't understand, is that a narcissist can turn violent without any notice.
Right.
And you are in danger. And I had to plan and execute an escape. And I did that. And went to stay with my parents at 43. No job, no marriage. And he had actually bankrupted us. He blew about $2 million in assets. We're just gone. A lot of narcissists self-destruct. It's very common. And he was exactly like that. When I got out, I was so traumatized. I was driving through stop signs and red lights. And I knew I was in trouble. And I knew I needed help. And I made a promise to myself that I would never, ever go through something like that again. And I knew that I needed to take a long, hard look at myself to understand why that happened and how to prevent it from happening again. Mm-hmm. And I got to work. And I was willing to do any work that was necessary. And I got to work with licensed, credentialed therapists, EMDR specialists. I've worked with life coaches and healing process. And I even, at that point, was at what I call, and many people in recovery understand as, your surrender point. And I actually looked up at the sky and said, okay, I'm all yours. I don't know what else to do.
Wow.
And that's when things started to get better. And when I started working with coaches and therapists. And it's been really a 10-year journey of healing. And I think it's really important that people understand that this kind of healing journey takes time. And it takes commitment. But it is very doable. And every day things got a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better. Yeah. And then I started, you know, working with some really interesting coaches, a retired Navy SEAL, Commander Mark Devine, who has a civilian training program and five times New York Times bestseller, in-person events, online programs. He's just completed his PhD in leadership.
Wow.
Really interesting guy. And he has combined yoga, breath work with military Navy SEAL training. And that is where I learned to thrive. And I have created the life that I want. I live in the place where I want to live. And I follow the pursuits and my love of skiing and hiking and being in the outdoors. And I'm in the perfect place for it. But that is what I chose, and I created it because I did the work in order to be able to do that.
Yes. Well, just take a break for a second. Take a breath.
There's a lot in there.
there was. There absolutely was. And first of all, thank you for sharing all of that so honestly. And I'm sorry that you went through so many things.
Yeah.
But congratulations to you. And, you know, that's really impressive to me that you are. I think there's probably still a little bit that needs to be healed. I don't know that we ever get 100% healed.
Right.
But, I, you know, the fact that you are as far down the road as you mm-hmm. are, I so appreciated what you said about the length of time mm-hmm. that it takes. I often think that people want it to be a quick fix. And so they will say things like, well, you know, you've had three therapy sessions. That's enough. You should be finished. You should be done. Right. Or, you know, just get over it.
That's my favorite.
Yeah. And to have those kinds of things happen to you, and I would like, if you don't mind, to go back in a minute or two and just talk about some of the signals that made the school say that you had dyslexia and, you know, what the kind of things that you went through and talk a little bit more about your schooling. But to go through the bullying, to have the different things said about you to you when you were so young, that develops deeper patterns in our brain mm-hmm. than if something was a slight trauma when right. we were older.
Right.
And it takes a long time maybe a way to give it a picture would be, it's like the Grand Canyon,
right?
When those kinds of things happen. And then you have to fill in mm-hmm. and build new, healthier avenues in your brain mm-hmm. to get from point A to point B. But even sometimes the stuff that you thought you had mm-hmm. sometimes manages to come back to the surface somehow.
Right. Right.
And so that's where I say, I don't know that our healing is ever 100%, but right. I think we then have the coping strategies and we recognize some of the things. And so we are able to deal with them better.
Right.
But yeah.
I think you're exactly right. And I still work with a therapist. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's very important to me. And I do it very intentionally. And I actually go digging for those things. I go digging for the trauma, because I have learned that if I address it and work with an EMDR specialist to rewire the brain and create new pathways, which would probably be another term that, mm-hmm. I own it. Yes. I'm in charge, not the trauma. And it's unaddressed, it owns me, you know? And I think, you know, to your point about the experience as a child, I think what happens is you impose an identity on that child. Mm-hmm. And when I began to heal, that identity was that I was dyslexic, brain damaged, broken, unworthy, subhuman. And that message was very clear to me. Even though it was never spoken to me, you know, children know when they're being treated differently. They know.
Yep.
And those little condescending pats on the head are very clear messages.
Yes.
So when I got to work with a coach, it was really interesting because he said to me, he said, "Oh my gosh, I'm intimidated in working with you. You're so accomplished." I was like, "Wait, what?" I was like, no, you don't understand. I'm dyslexic. I'm brain damaged. I'm broken." Mm-hmm. And it must have been the right time in my life. And, you know, what is that saying that we attribute to Buddha? When the student is ready, the teacher arrives.
Yeah.
He said to me, "Ellen, that is the biggest bunch of BS I have ever heard." He said, "You have been gaslighted into believing that." Mm. And I went, "Whoa." And that started a whole new thought process and a whole new part of my own self-exploration. Because if he was right, then who was I?
Right.
And I actually had to let go of that part of my identity. And I did that through meditation, breath work, a lot of meditation, a lot of breath work, a lot of yoga, mm-hmm. a lot of time in silence. And letting that go as a process. And then for a short period of time, you know, I felt this emptiness because, okay, who am I? Now what do I do? And then started to really, through that work, really started to get in touch with who Ellen is and understood that. But I actually had to grieve that part of my identity as well, which was really interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that, please.
So when you have a big change like that, or you realize you're not who people told you you are, that's a loss. It's a, there's a piece of you that you believed to be true that is now you know to be false. And when it's false, you can let go of it because it's not real. But there's still that, there's almost an emptiness that comes along with that, that comes along with grieving perhaps a loved one or such, you know, or a job or something that was important to you or a piece of your life. And I began to fill that with who, when I discovered or was discovering the authentic Ellen. And I'm grateful for that because I know exactly who I am. And you know what? She's pretty cool.
Well, I mean, I'm a pretty good judge of character, and I think so, just in the little bit that I've known you. So,
Thank you. And I mean that from a self-esteem, you know, perspective.
Right. Yeah, and it does. I mean, I grew up, and I don't know what caused me to have this low self-esteem, but I did. And yeah, it took a long time for me to like Shelley and think that Shelley is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, but there, like I said, sometimes you get that, you know, you think you've got it covered up, buried, healed, whatever. And then all of a sudden it creeps back up, you know? So I do still have my moments, you know, where I'm like, and I never want to get to the part where I think, oh, I'm the be all to end all of, you know, every human should be exactly like me.
Right.
But I do want to continue to, you know, think well of myself. I am made in the image of God, and there's not a better image to be made from.
Right.
And so I definitely should appreciate who I am and what he has done in my life. And before I forget, we do have Fran joining us. Thanks for posting in. Happy, howdy from Southern Illinois. So thanks for joining us, Fran. So I want to go back a little bit because you said you were told you had dyslexia at a young age. So what was it that, like I said, were the sort of signals that alerted the school staff and maybe yourself to go, something's different here?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it starts out with, you know, first being diagnosed as ambidextrous.
Okay.
So I was not favoring one hand or the other. And that to them was disconcerting, I think would be the word that I would use. And I remember them giving me this test with a tennis ball, and the special education teacher would stand, maybe 8-10 feet away from me. And she bounced the tennis ball on the floor so it would come right to my midline. And she wanted to see which hand I reached out for it. Now, the logical thing to do is if you send it right to my midline, I'm going to catch it with both hands. And I still remember this test. And I remember the look on her face of dismay when I caught the ball with both hands. And we did this several times. And then we'd do it maybe twice a week. And this went on for a couple months.
Okay.
And I still kept catching it with my both hands.
Right.
And that is what led to other testing.
Interesting.
Yes. So again, this was a long time ago. So, you know, this was, you know, this was the 1970s.
Right.
And so I'm sure perspectives and theories, learning theory is trained, or at least I hope it's changed dramatically. So it was after the testing that I was sent out to special education one-on-one training in other classrooms. And that's when I knew something was different because I was being separated from my peers.
Right. Yeah.
And that's when the bullying started, because now I was different.
Right. Yes.
And that was my experience all the way through elementary school.
Did other teachers ever see the potential in you that those original teachers said, oh, she'll never go to college. You need to find a husband to take care of her.
Right. Yes. So the condemnation really came from the administrator, not the mainstream teachers.
Okay.
And this is where I really need to speak to the amazing teachers who are out there, because not all teachers had this belief system. And right. I was fortunate enough to have an amazing teacher. Her name is Mrs. Gillis. I'm sure she's passed away many years ago, but she was close to retiring when I was in kindergarten. So, but she was a woman who was living her purpose. She was the perfect teacher. And I never felt that I was different when I was with her. Mm-hmm. And I always felt, you know, respected, and I loved her. Her and my mom were actually very good friends too. So I did have some teachers who were just phenomenal and who were, you know, and thank God for them.
Right.
So, and it really varied as I, you know, moved through the education system. There were always good teachers and there were always not so good teachers. So
yeah,
I did have a lot of good ones. So,
well, that's very good to hear, because it seems like too often I don't hear about students who are different learners. And that is always what I called myself when I was a special education teacher. We would have to say, you know, what I like when the websites came out and they would put our pictures up there, put our names, you know, and I remember having the technology person say, well, what do you want to be called? Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm the teacher of different learners. And, you know, I would always, because it, like when I first got my degree, I was really focused in on, at that time in Illinois where I live, you could get a degree in learning disabilities, a degree in behavioral disabilities, and a degree in, mentally at that time, the really severe academic disabilities.
Sure.
And I always looked at LD to mean learns differently instead of learning disabled.
Yay.
Because to me, that is exactly what it is.
Yes.
It's not an inability to learn.
Right.
It's a different way. You know, I would say, you know, most brains go from point A to point B, straight mm-hmm. line, and they're fine.
Right.
But sometimes they might go from A and then go over to C and then D and then come back to mm-hmm. even A and then go to B. But right. they still got there.
Right.
It just looked different.
Right. Right.
And yeah. So, and trying to get people to understand that different does not mean bad.
Right. Right. You know, it's so interesting, because I think my mother hit the nail on the head. She used to say to me, it's so obvious that you're intelligent and capable. They just don't know how to teach you. Mm-hmm. And I think she was absolutely right.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And I think even like we were talking about, you know, that you didn't have a hand dominance.
Right.
Back when you and I went through grade school, if you weren't right-handed, mm-hmm. teachers did look at you as that there was something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't that you hadn't, that you didn't have A dominant, if you were left hand dominant, mm-hmm. they wanted to, I mean, I've heard the horror stories
of
people who were naturally left handed, but were forced to write right handed.
My father was one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
He went to public school in New York City and he was rapped on the wrist with a ruler. And that's not even a Catholic school. It was a public school, and he was forced to be right-handed, and he struggled with his handwriting all his life because it wasn't his natural hand.
Yeah. And that does something to the brain when you try to rewire it, which is basically what you are trying to do when you say somebody is right-handed and you try to make them left-handed, or they're left-handed and you try to make them right-handed. Yeah. I have become ambidextrous over my lifetime mm-hmm. because when I first got out of school, I went and became a paraprofessional back in the school where I had been a student. And working with the kids, there was a couple kids who were left-handed. And I happened to work at the grade level where cursive writing was taught.
Yes.
And so, you know, you got to turn your paper differently. Your everything is, you know, at a, and the teacher in the classroom couldn't do it. You know, right. She's just like, well, you're going to, you know, and it was, I mean, I felt so bad for the kids. So I went home at night and I just practiced until I could, I mean, it's not beautiful. I'm definitely more right-handed, but I can do almost everything with my left hand that mm-hmm. I can do with my right hand. It might be a little awkward.
Right.
But the more I would practice, I mean, if I would practice it as much with my left hand as I have with my right hand, I would be equally as good.
Right. You know, it's so interesting. I had some marksmanship training a couple years ago and with Commander Devine and his coaches. And I tried using, you know, focusing with my left eye and couldn't hit the side of a barn.
Wow. Yep.
I learned, you know, we tried it right with my right eye, left hand, right eye, and I couldn't miss.
Wow. That's so cool.
It was really interesting. Yeah.
I'm interested to know what this means, Fran. It says you're a conundrum now.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking she's not right, left, or she just, I don't know. Be interested to see what she responds.
You know, I think that I'm just naturally ambidextrous. I just may have some tendencies one way or the other. And I think it kind of varies what I'm doing. You know, I have had to learn, you know, I showed some tendencies towards being left-handed, so I write with my left hand. You know, with my marksmanship skills, now it's my right eye seems to work better for me. I think it just depends on the task
mm-hmm.
of what is more comfortable. Other than that's, I guess, the only way that I can explain it. It's, I think it's just how I'm built. And I'm pretty clear that this is genetic, you know, because my father was, though not diagnosed, he believed that he was dyslexic. And same thing, you know, forced to be right-handed, but naturally he would have been left-handed and also an excellent marksman.
That's so cool.
Pretty interesting. Yeah. And dyslexia is known to run in families. That's pretty well understood that, or is accepted as common. It's just, you know, previous generations weren't necessarily diagnosed.
Right. Yeah. And I think we still have a lot of people that are dyslexic that are not being diagnosed properly. They are given that term because, again, that umbrella of the eligibility for special education is learning disability.
Yeah.
And so in Illinois, we actually have a whole handbook about dyslexia that was put out by our State Board of Education. I know that not every state has that,
right.
But the fact that we acknowledge it a little bit, at least, mm-hmm. here in Illinois, where other states are like, nope, we're not going to even mention it
exactly.
anywhere
exactly.
in the IEP.
Exactly.
And so, so here's what Fran says. She said some things are better with her left side, and that's what she means by driver's side. She's actually a friend of mine, and she had a stroke several years ago that has wonked up her sense of numbers and
okay.
left and right and up and down.
Okay.
And so she's learned strategies like to say the driver's side or the passenger side,
yes.
or, you know, things like that. So, yep. So yeah.
And in my way of compensating, cause I still struggle with my left and right. My way of working around that, like you're mentioning skills to get around those things. Mm-hmm. I was taught at a very young age how to use a compass. So I orient myself in the direction I'm going in. And it was so funny. I was just talking with a friend about this over the weekend and he was so like, what? Perplexed. Because we were up in the mountains and I was like, oh, well, the tunnel's that way. Cause that way is east. The Eisenhower Tunnel on Route Interstate 70 through the mountains.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's, and that's often a traffic nightmare. So it's a good landmark, and you can't really get into the mountains without going through there. And because I, if you give me directions and you tell me like a left here, a right here, and then make another right, I'm completely lost. But if you tell me to go north, south, east, west, I'm good. I will not get lost. And I'm always oriented on the compass. I always have one point, you know, so I, when I grew up on Fire Island, Long Island sticks out in the ocean. So the ocean was always south. So I would always, if I knew that the ocean was south, I could orient myself to the other three points on the compass. And then what was funny was when I moved to New England and I lived in southern New Hampshire and northern Massachusetts, the ocean is east.
Right.
And it took me a good year to reorient my brain that the ocean was east, not south.
Yeah.
So it's just a different way of kind of managing things. So.
Yeah. And thankfully I can do directions both ways. I was born with a good sense of direction, and I do tend to think though that cardinal directions come more naturally to me than if you tell me go left, go right, you know, or landmarks. I come from a rural area and, you know, landmarks, okay, well, you just go up here to the Casey's, you know, in the next town, and then you make a right, and then you, you know, go 4 mile or whatever. Right. You know, so landmark usage is another way to to give directions.
Yes. Well, the, you know, the joke in New England, and I know it's a little off topic, but this is kind of funny. The joke in New England is, go straight on Main Street till you see the Dunkin' Donuts and then make a left and then keep going till you see the next Dunkin' Donuts and make a right. And then the next Dunkin' Donuts and you make a left.
Nice, nice. I like all the Dunkin' Donuts. Awesome. Yeah, awesome. Really
cool. It works too, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that is, that is interesting. Our Dunkin' Donuts would be like a Casey's. It seems like every small town on the highways, there's a Casey's in almost every small town around here. Sure. But yeah, so yeah, let's get back on the topic of, of growing up. And one of the things you had told me, and you mentioned it earlier too, but, in the form that I have my guests fill out, is that being told that you had a learning disability was a death sentence to you.
It was.
And you did, you mentioned that, you know, in the 70s, when we were growing up and starting our school career, that most definitely was a death sentence. I want to give you another perspective because I often have had students tell me when they were found eligible for special education due to a learning disability, that actually made them feel better about themselves because then they knew it wasn't something, you know, they weren't broken. They, it wasn't something that they were controlling or causing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I can definitely see though, both sides of that same coin.
Right. And I think some of it is the bias that came with it at that time. In the belief system. And what's interesting is I've done a lot of podcasts with, there's been a lot of interest in the UK and the Commonwealth countries. Mm-hmm. And they seem to have a kind of a different perspective. They're more curious rather than the experience that I had. It felt like I was blamed.
Right.
And like, oh, it's her brain. And again, I realized that this was 50 years ago. So that has to be taken into consideration. And I think I can understand why there'd be some relief. I think for me, it was really about the belief at that time that was made it so detrimental.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like I said, the two sides of the coin, it really depends on who's flipping that coin.
Exactly.
You know, if you get those teachers who are limiting your potential because they think that you're not going to be, and like I said, even now, even in 2025, I know there are people who believe that because someone is eligible for special education, their life is going to end up worse.
Right. Or that and, it's perceived as an intellectual disability.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I look, and again, why the show came about is, I mean, I look, there's a lot of very famous people mm-hmm. who have disabilities of some kind. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that Einstein probably had autism or ADHD or both, or maybe even a learning disability. There are, you know, like Elon Musk, I believe, is autistic. The guy, and I can never remember, I don't know why I can never remember his name, but the Virgin Atlantic owner, Richard Branson. Yes. You know, he's another one who I think it was dyslexia. There's, I mean, and I actually used to have my students research whatever they were eligible for under special education and find people who were successful with that same eligibility. Mm-hmm. And so I used to have a list like 3, 4, 5, 6 pages long.
It's long.
You know, 2 columns or 3 columns, because if they were having trouble finding somebody, you know, because at that time it was a lot of, you know, we didn't have the internet. So it was a lot of, you know, okay, you're going to have to look this up in the encyclopedia, or you're going to have to, you know. Yep. And so a lot of that stuff wasn't as available as it is now. But
right.
I mean, if you're going to tell me that someone like Richard Branson is not successful, yeah. I mean, I don't know what your version of success is, but right. I don't see a lot of people as successful as, you know, I shouldn't say successful if that's not, they're living the kind of life that he lives that are quote unquote normal, or, you right. know, they fall within that bubble of the bell curve. And yeah, I don't know how to change people's concepts, but mm-hmm. I'm hoping that the more stories like yours and the other 195 stories that I've shared so far, yeah. that when people see how life can be for mm-hmm. anybody, mm-hmm. that will start to change their heart. Cause that's where I believe it has to be changed.
Right.
Cause we can have all the head knowledge and all the laws and all the, you know, all the stuff up here. Mm-hmm. But even though this is where the thoughts and the beliefs come from,
I agree.
I think we have to change the heart
mm-hmm.
in order to change this.
Yes. And I think that's where the therapy or the somatic work, the breath work, the time and silence, I think that focuses on the heart center and the heart chakras, if you will, as well as the gut, because we have a gut mm-hmm. intelligence in addition to our hearts. So, and yes. that was one of the things that kept me going, was I knew deep down inside that they were wrong. My gut knew that. My heart knew that.
Yeah.
And that's why I never quit on myself, because I just knew it. I couldn't necessarily express it, but I knew it. It was yeah. really, really, it was powerful.
Yeah. And for you to have that, not everybody has that. And so yeah. as they are, there's a song that I listen to, and I believe it's called The Truth. And it starts off with, how many times can you hear the same lies before you start to believe them?
Well, I had another side of a coin. I had the ace in my pocket, which was my parents.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was my cheerleader. Our mantra was, prove them wrong, Ellen, prove them wrong. You know you can do it. You know you can do it. That was our mantra.
Yeah.
So if I didn't have that, we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
Right.
I guarantee it. And it wasn't right. just one parent. It was both of them. And I really strive to give them credit, because I want other, because of what they did, but also for other parents to understand the difference that they can make is massive. And just by believing in your child, loving your child, supporting them unconditionally will change the trajectory of their life.
Yep.
It's not complicated.
Yeah. They very likely will be the only ones in your corner always.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I attribute the book to them.
Yeah. So let's talk about the book.
Oh, sure. So
there it is. Yes, absolutely.
There we go.
Disempowered, but the dis is crossed out. I love that.
Yes. My best friend came up with that title.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I was struggling to figure out the name of the title, and her boyfriend and I had just finished skiing, and we were having a beer at Garfunkel's in Vail, of all places. And I was reading her this list. I'm like, Sarah, I'm struggling with the title. I'm reading her all these ideas, and she's like, no, no, no. And she just blurts out. She's like, how about disempowered with a D-I-S crossed out? And I just looked at her and went, oh my God, that's it.
Yep. So. Yeah. When you hear it, you know it. That's kind of how it happened with the title of my book too. I just like, sure. Lord gave it to me right before bed one night. And I sat straight up in bed and I was like, I got the title of the book.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell what the book's about and tell how people can get the book.
Sure. So it's all about the growing up dyslexic, you know, like we talked about before, the struggles I had as a child, but I also really dive into some of the adventures I've had. I dive into the Outward Bound. I dive into the, no pun intended, scuba diving certification. And the time that I spent with my father on his boat and the fishing that we did together and how important that was. And I am very frank with, you know, talking about the abuse in my marriage. But I also talk about a college boyfriend who was really a lifesaver for me. Because he and that relationship was a very healthy, loving relationship. And I knew the difference.
Hmm.
And also having such a good father, I'd had an example of I had a positive male role model in my life. And then having a boyfriend who actually happened to be in the Marine Corps. So it's kind of funny. But, you know, I knew how it felt when a man truly loves a woman.
Yeah.
And I never forgot that. And that was one of the reasons why I got out of the marriage, because I knew it was wrong. I actually start out the book with my surrender point. I do jump around to these different adventures and things like that. And then towards the end, you know, I talk about the healing and learning to thrive again. And I talk about, you know, the training with Mark Devine, retired SEAL, and his program and some of the adventures I had with him, including, they call it beach games now, but another name is surf torture. They take you out on the beach and they do, you know, your linked arms with your boat crew and the waves are crashing over your head. And I laughed all the way through it. It was a great experience. But I talk about not only the experience, but what I got from them and how it's brought me to where I am today. And, you know, just I live a life of gratitude. And I tell my story because I want people to understand that you can completely recreate your life on your terms. But you got to do the work and you got to heal before you
can. And where do they get this book?
Sure. So it's on Amazon. There's also an Audible version. For all the dyslexic people out there who don't like to read or really still struggle with it. Also at barnesandnoble.com. And I do occasional book signings particularly in Boulder. I'm right outside of Boulder. And I have events. I'm also a member of the Colorado Authors League. So we have events that we do around the state as well. So.
Perfect. That sounds wonderful. So you have a website. And let me just pull that back up really quick.
Sure.
It is ellenbush.com and it's Ellen, E-L-L-E-N, Bush, B-U-S-C-H.com. And what will they find when they go there?
You'll find more information about my story. There's a lot of family pictures there. And then also that I'm a coach. I'm a certified coach, so I am available. You know, I talk a lot with women who are, you know, kind of struggling to understand where they are. And, you know, if they're in a marriage, I'm not a therapist. I want to be clear on that. And I often refer people to places where they can get support and help. And then also, you know, just people who may be dyslexic, or if you're a parent of a dyslexic child, and to help them to understand their child's perspective and what they're experiencing.
Beautiful. And then you also have, you're also on social media. So you are on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And I'm guessing if they just typed in Ellen Bush, it's going to pull those up. So you're inviting people to join you on any of those social platforms by sharing those with us today. Mm-hmm. And again, your website is ellenbush.com. It's time for us to wrap up already. This has been such a quick conversation.
Great.
Before we go, I mean, we do have just a tiny, tiny little bit of time left. I just want to make sure that we have covered what you had hoped to cover when you agreed to be my guest today. So if there's not, if there's something that we missed, now's that opportunity.
I don't think so. I think we covered, we can't completely unpack over 200 pages. So, but I think we covered pretty much everything that I've written about in what, you know, sometimes shortly, in short way, and other, in a little bit more in depth in other ways. But I hope people will read the book and, you know, reach out to me. I'm happy to answer questions. You know, set up a time to talk, especially if you're a parent or if you're a dyslexic person. You know, I've lived through this and I can help. And that's why I wrote the book, is it gives my suffering purpose when I can help somebody else out.
Yeah, I love that. Giving suffering purpose. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being my guest. And thank you to Fran, who joined us today and who commented. I very much appreciate any time that we have anybody who comments as we are live. And make sure, again, I'm just going to do this plug one more time. We are on episode 196. And so on April 1st, if all the rest of the guests between now and then show up, that will be episode 200. And that will be with Merle Evans. And again, make sure you like and subscribe so you don't miss that episode or any other episodes. That 200th episode is going to be a celebratory one. We're going to have jewelry, baseball tickets to the St. Louis Cardinals, Holiday World Splash and Safari in Santa Claus, Indiana tickets. We're going to have books to give away. And so make sure that you are with me that day, April 1st. It will, all the prizes will go out live. There will not be any on the replay. So you will have to join us live. And thank you so much for being with me today and for continuing to support hashtag No Limits. And remember, we know who we are, but not who we will be. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.